Okay, good afternoon. I think we will kick off as we've got a good and steady amount of attendees that have joined. So welcome everybody to another entry in our webinar series. So this week we are looking at ransomware on retail, particularly over the Easter period and actually extended well beyond that. We've seen a number of extremely impactful attacks that have targeted the retail sector. Probably most notably between them are the M&S and Co-op attacks and breaches that both organizations are still sort of reeling from, still trying to get back on their feet fully. Responsibility for these incidents have been claimed or attributed to the same group or groups, actually. And that's something that we're going to get to the bottom of, as that's not a simple, straightforward answer, particularly when we start looking at one of the groups in particular. So although these attacks were against the retail sector, they expose important learnings that every organization can benefit. And really, that's the essence of the webinar today. Yes, probably very helpful for people in the retail sector, but also we strongly believe that actually, and particularly when we start looking at some of the attacks that similar or the same threat actor groups have carried out, they're not just limited to retail. I think it's something that we can all benefit from. It's also important to note that we can only base this on what is known. There's been no official full incident reports released publicly from either of them, but we have had drip-fed information. So information based on what's been released so far, what has been claimed, and what insiders have led on. But even if some of that is conjecture, it's all rooted in truth, as we know so much about the tactics and techniques used by the threat actor groups involved. This is not their first attack, and they're not strictly restricted to retail, as I mentioned. So, looking at that, looking at what we know, I think we can pull some clear insights and really talk through what's happened, and then dive down into the lessons that we should be learning from it and how we can mitigate. So I think if we move on to the next slide, please, Patrick. And that brings me to the point of introducing you. So obviously, I'm Rich Ford, the CTO and sort of regular host for these webinars. But today, to talk through this, we have an expert in the field, particularly when it comes to dealing with incidents, which is Patrick Ragg, who is head of our incident response unit. So Patrick, I'll just hand over to yourself to give a brief intro.
Yeah, hi Rich, thanks. So I've been in incident response for a number of years now, been at Integrity for about 4.5 years. My kind of bread and butter is ransomware. That's what my team does day in, day out. This is a particular interest to me, especially since I know someone that's in the M&S breach. But I won't mention any names, obviously. So
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Patrick. So let's have a quick look at the agenda, if we could, Patrick, and we can walk through what we're going to touch upon today. So we're going to, I've done our introduction. So we're going to look at, why retail and also why it matters to all of us in a bit more detail. Then we're going to touch down and look at those threat actor groups and threat actors that are involved and look at what we can extract from those in terms of their approach, the tactics, techniques, but also a wider view on the industry of ransomware. And then we're going to look at the attacks themselves. So breaking it down into M&S from what we know and understand, because again, we can pull learnings from that, and then Co-op. It's probably important to mention that the attacks haven't been limited to M&S and Co-op. There was an attempted attack on Harrods that was thwarted. And we also saw some attacks against Dior that have been classified in a similar way, along with others. And then we're going to look at sort of the ever-evolving tactics as part of that, and then the lessons that we can very much learn from these attacks. And then, as always, we will jump into a Q&A. So please make use of the Q&A function within Zoom, and please post your questions, and myself and Patrick will do our best to answer those as best as possible at the very end. So let's have a look at retail. Why retail? What are the unique security challenges? Why would attackers, particularly as we've seen a string against retail, why would they attack it? Well, the 24/7 sort of business operations, that's you might say, most of my shops are closed in the evening, which is not true for major supermarkets that operate 24/7, but even outside of them, they have long supply chains that they operate internally that are operating 24 by 7 that can be impacted, but also can be targeted. So having people available 24 by 7, if we look at the potential for social engineering, potential for taking advantage, particularly of people fatigued, there is always that opportunity. The retail sector collects and stores a large amount of customer data, and even sort of sensitive customer data. So it makes them a very good target, particularly as that data can be stolen, not just to extort the organization, but also to look at how they can extort or use that to pull the levers to help with the extortion, targeting the end users, but also of how they can use that information in future and further attacks. And Patrick, I'm sure he'd agree, and just a nod will probably do, Patrick, but quite often the incidents that your team are responding to have a root cause in credential stuffing, where stolen credentials are being used over and over again to where people are using the same password. So a little bit of a lessons learned there. Don't use the same password. And also, if you've deployed any externally facing applications, particularly VPN, make sure that there is MFA in place. And if there's not, as soon as we finish this webinar, I'd go and fix that ASAP. The impact against the retail sector can be felt instantly. We've seen that particularly being able to not transact, be able to not bring in the supplies and the stock to make sure that the shelves are fully stocked. What is also unique in terms of retail is having large OT deployments, particularly as that supply chain and being able to do the packing, the sorting, and delivering, which is fully automated now end to end. Some very high-end technology delivering those. But also we've got the points of sale environments, which obviously, as a threat attack surface, the challenge around them is quite often around the vulnerabilities that are in those, particularly as they're not operating on standard operating systems. And there's obviously challenges around patching all of those appliances. As a retail organization, particularly where there's lots of stores involved, as we have in these two examples that we're going to talk through, we have a high number of satellite sites. So again, extending that threat attack surface, and also extending it out online. So, having online shops that are prone to DDoS attacks to take them offline, but also bot attacks to be able to exploit them. And again, another avenue of attack. And lastly, as you'd expect, and I've mentioned the supply chain, but heavily reliant on the supply chain. And quite often, and I'll touch upon this a little bit later, quite often in two directions, being the supplier as well as the recipient or supplier maybe as part of that supply chain. Now that's what's unique to retail. So if we have a look at what's not unique to retail, and be forgiven for sort of claiming, well, actually, Rich, you've got all the same things on there. And that's because it's completely true. And that's why we think it's so important for us to look at these attacks and what we can learn from them. Most organizations have an element of their business that run 24 by 7. So that is not unique to UTEP. That's something that's important to all of us. We also, most organizations will collect and store customer data, whether that's business to business, whether that's business to consumer, storing that data that will be of relevance to attackers, but also a relevance to yourselves to use for extortion. We all feel the impacts pretty much instantly, bringing our businesses down if we have a breach. Many organizations have OT environments, particularly when we look at the utility sector, when we look at the energy sector, manufacturing, so all OT environments that can still be targeted. Many organizations have satellite offices. Many organizations have applications that are delivered online in the cloud for user interaction. Again, whether that's business to business, business to consumer. And we are all hugely reliant on the supply chain. We might say, well, actually, we don't bring in any parts or vegetables, but we all use things like Office 365 and other contractors and third parties to help us deliver our business, to help us run our business. So there's nobody, no organization now that doesn't have an element of supply chain risk and supply chain reliance. On top of that, what we all have is also limited IT and security resources. There is 4 million shortfall as a cybersecurity skills gap at the moment. 300,000 of those are across Europe. 400,000 are across the continent of Africa. And so something that is constantly challenging us. But we also are all exposed to insider threat. I think that's really important in this case. And I'll come on to that a little bit later. But when we start thinking about the insider threat, we start thinking about our own employees. But actually, when we start getting into the details of how threat actors operate once they've breached those perimeters, actually, it's really the same controls we need to think about from an insider threat perspective. So let's start looking at the threat actors involved. Now, everybody was very quick to call out that it was Scattered Spider or Octo Tempest. I think in the next slide we've got even more names for them. But it's important to call out that actually Scattered Spider, Octo Tempest, whatever you want to call them, they're not a formalized threat actor group or organized cybercrime group that we would normally expect. They're actually really a loosely affiliated group of cybercriminals from very much from the wider community of cybercriminals, which has been termed the COM. And Joel, they have, we're linking those threat actors, the individual threat actors, the individual cybercriminals, by looking at the tactics that they're using. Also identified as being English speaking, so based, assumed to be based across the US and the UK. We've actually seen arrests in the UK and the US, actually more in the UK, which did have a big impact on the operation of the loosely termed group Scattered Spider. So we saw a drop off from their attacks, but they have now resurfaced and re-engaged overall. And they're also linked to other threat actor groups such as Alpha or Alpha V, however you want to pronounce that, Black Cat, and others. So, it's not standing alone, and we're seeing that affiliation. And they're very much less of the advanced persistent threat that we would associate with nation-state actors, the big organized crimes. Lapsus is one example, but more of the advanced persistent teenagers that are attacking our environment. So very young or teens, so young adults or teens that have identified actually this is a great way for us to extort and make money and move into these areas. And as I mentioned, they're not just been involved in these retail threats, but also into plenty of other high-profile breaches. There was the MGM and Caesars casinos breaches that occurred. And obviously, there were two separate breaches. Again, clearly a concerted effort towards one area and one industry. They've been identified or fingered as part of the Snowflake breach. There's also Visa and other financial institutes. So they have a long history of successful breaches and really moving from specific industry area to other to another one. Probably because the same tactics are working across each one, they can move laterally across those. So I'm just going to hand over to Patrick and ask Patrick to really dive down into Scattered Spider, what the attacker profile actually is.
Thanks, Rich. So these guys have been around since 2022. So the motivation is primarily financial. That tends to be the majority of ransomware threat actors these days is financial. So gone are the days of hacktivism. They're still around, obviously. Sort of 20 to 30% of threat actors do follow the hacktivism side of things, but most of them have just kind of realized that it's such a big business. They're going to make a lot of money. And that's why financial is the primary motivator at the moment. And that kind of ties into the next point, which is the type. So Scattered Spider, in terms of ransomware, from a bigger picture, like from a business point of view, they're known as a ransomware as a service affiliate. So I'm going to go into a bit more detail of how that works with the other organizations or the other groups of that structure in the next slide. But basically what that means is that they are a specific role. They have a specific role in the ransomware hierarchy as a business. And I'm going to go into that in a bit more later. They, as Rich mentioned earlier, they're also known as Octo Tempest. They have many different names. UNC 3944 is the original one I remember them coming out a couple of years ago. I remember that was the first one that came up. That was the first name. I can't remember exactly who that was named by. It might have
That
been
was
Mark
that was Mandian. And actually,
Mandian.
I think one of the things that I often think is, you know, on the one hand, I know there's actually, you know, so many commentators talk about the challenge that we face with so many different disparate names being able to link the different threat actors together. We can see that with this one of how many different names that we've got here for them. But you probably also question that giving them cool names like Octo Tempest and Scatter Spider probably does nothing to deter anybody, and it's probably, you know, a bit of kudos getting you know, a cool name from CrowdStrike is probably a badge of honor. So probably something for the industry to think about in general.
Yeah, it's more of a badge, really. It's like a something to enjoy, like for infamy, isn't it? Right. So, and I read an article the other day. One of the three kind of like Microsoft, I think CrowdStrike were doing something as well. And Mandiant were combining to have like a combined list of names, because it doesn't do anyone any good when you got five different names for one threat actor. So it's good. I prefer the old APT, you know, APT 30 or whatever. It's just more simpler. But anyway, primary TTP, so this is the tactics, techniques, and procedures of Scattered Spider. They are heavy on the social engineering side. And I mean, with obvious the motivation behind that is obvious because it's so successful. But one of their techniques is SIM swapping. So the way SIM swapping works is you can basically, if you can convince a mobile carrier such as, you know, Vodafone or EE or something, you know, one of those, that you are the owner of a phone number and you want to change your phone number to something else, then they will basically give you a they will swap your number over. So essentially, where MFA, so multi-factor authentication, is used to authenticate, for example, you get a text message or like when you click on reset password and it sends a message to double check that you are who you say you are. If a threat actor swaps a SIM right at the last minute, they can then get your authentication code and then they've logged in, and by then it's too late. So that's effectively what SIM swapping is. I'll probably go into this later, but there are certain protections you can do against that. But one of the things that's come out of this M&S and co-op breach is that there's been a lot of pressure from governments, especially the UK government, on mobile carriers to do their due diligence when checking, you know, if a legitimate if a SIM swap is a legitimate request. SMS phishing is you know, the likes of sending messages to that have basically phishing in the same way that an email is through SMS. And then help desk impersonation as well is one of their big TTPs. So help desk impersonation can go both ways. So you can have the threat actor pretending to be the help desk and then calling a user. So we've seen that a lot with the spam email bombing campaigns. And then on the other hand, you've got the threat actor pretending to be an employee to phish the help desk to basically say, you know, I want to reset my password. Can you give me access? And I can't get to the phone. I can't use my phone, or I can't get to my email. Credential dumping. These
Just,
two.
and I think just before we jump onto that, I think it's important how we link those together, particularly as you kind of talked about with you know, that one-time password reset being sent. You know, SIM swapping really enables that if you've targeted a user. I think that just also talks to, you know, how targeted the attacks are, not just looking at the organization but the users, being able to personalize those. I think there's also a link into, you know, the world of deepfakes that is emerging, as it's very easy to be able to impersonate someone by feeding information in that, not just their voice and what you want them to say, although you can make it real time where possible, but also their personality into it. So, which obviously very much helps with that social engineering side, if the person that they're calling actually knows them in some way, shape, or form, overall. So I think there's probably, and we probably touch upon some of these mitigations later on, but there's definitely things that we need to start putting in place.
Sounds good. Yeah, and onto credential dumping. So the dumping of me, sorry, use the use of Mimikatz. So Mimikatz is a common program used by threat actors to crack passwords, to extract passwords from dumps. Most notably in Windows, it's the lsas.exe process dump, and then the ntds.dit. I'm not going to name exactly what that means because it's really long, but it's the basically the Active Directory database, and I'd say most organizations have some form of Active Directory as their kind of base of infrastructure. The ntds.dit is the brains of that. So it's got all the credentials, all the group policies. It's got all the credential hashes. Basically, everything an attacker would. It's the crown jewels of the domain. Basically, everything an attacker would want if they got into your environment. So then
And
last but not
just
least.
actually, just on what that is, because I did just look it up quickly. It's new technology, directory services, directory information tree. So as you said, it's quite the mouthful. I think we'll just stick with the NTDS.dit.
Yeah, that's exactly why I didn't. Microsoft loves to put NT in front of everything, so NTLM or NTDS or yeah, new technology. Lateral movement. Yeah, abusive SSH, RDP, PSEC, persistence. You've got RMM tools are absolutely rife at the moment. So you still get a few incidents here and there where it's Cobalt Strike or Brute Retell. You know, classic C2 frameworks, but I think RMMs in the last kind of 100 incidents that we've done, 99 of them have had some form of RMM, like AnyDesk or ConnectWise or something like that. And part of that's because they just get on, they don't get detected. They're legitimate pieces of software, but they're just essentially a way in. Oh yeah, don't forget quick assist. So just an FYI, quick assist is built into every Windows machine by default. So make sure you disable that if you don't use it as a legit tool that's built in. You can check that by doing Control Windows Key Q. So just FYI on that. Then ransomware deployment. So as I said earlier, these guys are an affiliate. These guys use ransomware from other organizations. So I'm talking ransomware operators. So they've been seen to use the likes of Alfvea or Black Hat. And Dragon Force ransomware, as in the case of the M&S breach. So just to go into a bit more of a detail on how the business structure of ransomware works, usually what you have is you have an operator, a ransomware operator, and a ransomware affiliate. The ransomware affiliate is the primary motivator, the primary group that wants to the ransom a company. They get most of the profit. They do the majority of the work, and basically they request the services of a ransomware operator. So in this case, the affiliate was Scattered Spider. They did the initial access, they did the lateral movement, they did the persistence, pretty much 80% of the breach. And then the final 20% of the breach, they hired the services of Dragon Force, who are a ransomware operator, who offer their ransomware for breaches, basically. So they offer their ransomware. They also offer a dedicated leak site, so they operate it. They host the leak site as well, so the threat actor can upload data to that, upload files for download on the dark web, and they also facilitate the ransom payment and ransomware chats as well. So the negotiations in the chats as well. So whereas in terms of the actual chat though, who actually chats to who in terms of the customer or sorry the victim and either of those orgs, it's the affiliate. So in this case, Scattered Spider would be talking to M&S directly through the chat program or chat tool that Dragon Force was hosting. So Dragon Force are acting as the messenger in that case. So that's how
And
that works.
another example of supply chain reliance, but on the other side in this instance. But yeah, it's amazing that I think most people, when they think of ransomware as a service, they think of just about the software to encrypt an organization. But it is, you know, so much more in terms of the services provided, as well, end-to-end service, as you say. You know, there's 80% done by one, but then 20% by another group. And actually, what we've seen is both groups looking to claim. That they were part of that breach to take the, I guess, the kudos, particularly, I suppose, if you're the ransomware operator, you obviously want to you know, drum up business with other attacking groups to make use of your tools because it's a paid service.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why affiliates use operators, so they use another organization's ransomware, is mostly because it takes time and effort to create ransomware that actually works. You've got that many different antiviruses, EDRs out there, new techniques coming out to detect and to detect ransomware. So it's just easier if they, it's more cost effective if they just purchase ransomware from someone else. It's almost like it's a real business, really. You wouldn't, if you're building a car, you wouldn't necessarily create the software for the car. You'd purchase the software from, a manufacturer or something. So, it's just more efficient. So I'm going to go into some details about the M&S breach. So this is obviously, as Rich said earlier, this is some of this is not confirmed because we're all, I'm sure we're all awaiting the final incident report, depending on what kind of form that'll be, how much information that goes into. Seeing as they're a public organization, it probably will be quite public. It probably will detail quite a bit, as opposed to the Harrods one, for example. That won't, because it's a private organization. They don't have to release anything. But M&S might for the shareholders. But anyway, so it's believed that the threat actors got in through social engineering. They targeted a third party managed help desk. So it's alleged, and this has come out in a few BBC articles, that it was Tata Consulting was the third party in this case, and they haven't commented, but they are doing an internal investigation, and so obviously that can't be confirmed yet. But the Scattered Spider Group, they impersonated a user to trigger credentials reset. They used the interception of reset to hijack an account, so basically using SIM swapping, an alternate auth as well. Then lateral movement, it's thought that they were in the environment for around 3 months undetected. They dumped the ntds.dit file, as we mentioned earlier. That's one of their main techniques for all domain objects, and then they gained access to the VMware ESXi environment, so basically the hypervisor which hosts all of the ESXi clusters and hosts virtual machines, and they encrypted that from the hypervisor level. So the difference between the hypervisor level and, let's say, encrypting the operating system level is that it's much more effective, because you're encrypting the full VM for all the way from the boot level all the way through to the file system. Whereas if it's OS level, you're only encrypting the files on the file system. So it's a much more effective way of encrypting, and I obviously we can't confirm this, but the purely from the fact that they've been M&S have been doing this incident for what, about 4 or 5 weeks now, and they're still recovering, it sounds like backups were probably not that great, because in most sort of ransomware breaches we deal with, if they've got good backups, you can get them back up and running between a week, maybe a week or two. It just but then obviously the complexity of the org is got to come into it and all that other stuff. So I can't confirm that, but
I suppose on the other hand, it's the efforts and the ability to be able to confirm that the threat actor has been eradicated from that environment that can also slow that down. Because
yes.
obviously you don't want to try and go completely live again and find that actually they're still back in that environment and able to trigger a further attack.
Yeah, and there's no two incidents the same. So for one incident, for a ransomware incident, the threat actor might be really persistent, and they might, in those 3 months, they could do a lot. They could get the backdoors in everything. They could mess all the backups up, all that kind of stuff, if they really wanted to make an impact. Whereas if they are just a smash and grab kind of ransomware, like we've seen some incidents where they're only in for 2 hours and then they're ransomed after 2 hours. They didn't, they just want to get their money and go. They just want to cause the damage and go. It could be the former in this case. So they could have really got really deep into the backups. Maybe 3 months of backups are gone because they've all been compromised. So yeah, brand damage is roughly estimated to be about 300 million or higher. I think I learned somewhere it's like 10 million a day, 15 million pounds a day, something like that. And then they've, I think, 500 million was wiped off the share value. I believe it was 1 billion, but I think they've recovered a little bit of that back. Obviously, that's a fluctuating figure. So yeah, that's the M&S breach.
Yeah, and I think still unable to fulfill online orders, so that period has just gone on, and still challenged very much by it.
Yes.
And naturally, you know, disrupted supply chain as well, because they're also a supplier to other organizations. So it's not just an impact from to their customers directly, but also their indirect customers, that that is, you know, is further, I was going to say enhance the breach, but you know, increase the impact.
Sorry, and I just wanted to also mention, I saw a picture the other day of a very recent picture on Reddit of a person that works at M&S, and it was literally a warehouse full of sandwiches, food, all that, and it was literally going in the bin because they just couldn't shift it. They couldn't do the inventory, and so it was quite sad really, because they could give it to the homeless or whatever, but they couldn't because it's out of date, so they're technically not allowed. So, but yeah. So moving on to the co-op breach, I think slightly less is known about this one because the attack was after the M&S, or it's believed to be around the same time, but the information trickled out after, and the impact was less. And I'll go into why the impact was less. That's the kind of the last point in this. But essentially, the Scattered Spider Group did the same. It was the same method of initial access. So the social engineering. Coincidentally, as again, it's been stated that Tata Consulting was the third party here as well. But it's not. It's been not been. They've not been linked in terms of the breach yet. So there's no kind of confirmation there. And in this case is particularly interesting because there were reports of attackers gaining access to masquerading as basically employees on Teams. So they were internal employees. Their accounts had been compromised. All the attackers had created new accounts and then were joining Teams calls and, asking employees about the ransom. And the famously one conversation recorded from the co-op's head of cyber, where they got contacted by the threat actor via Teams, and that's how they found out about the breach, was that they contacted the head of cyber in this call. I mean, I can't imagine what that must have been like for him or her. A real kind of, freezing moment, like, what's going on here? Yeah, and then employees were told to keep cameras on during calls to verify identities and not record or transcribe calls, because basically at that point, co-op didn't fully know where the threat actor was and how deep they were in the network. So this was in the early days.
No,
So yeah.
and so yeah, particularly with how easy it is to do voice impersonation through AI methods and through deepfakes. I mean, videos are a touch harder, but still very possible to do in real time. But obviously, audio is much, much easier. I think keeping that camera on is, you know, also important from not just, you know, it's a person that I don't know that's talking to me, but you know, if we look at how do you trick people into how do you persuade them into doing things that they probably wouldn't want to do or wouldn't normally do? You know, it's looking, playing on fear, it's playing on authority. So, you know, combining those two, someone senior in the business giving you an order in the breach, and it's in their voice, you know, is very easy way to enforce that persuasion. So very, you know, quite a big consideration there, and you know, very prompt and correct response there is to make sure that the cameras are on. So you can verify exactly who you're talking to.
Yeah, and the final point with the co-op breach, this is probably one of the biggest questions of IR during an IR engagement, is should we pull the plug? That's what co-op did in this case, reportedly. So they pulled the plug as soon as they first realized that there was a breach, and I think obviously the M&S breach was a few days in at this point. They were like, right, let's just pull the plug. Let's just disconnect absolutely everything. And it that this actually stopped this actually prevented them the threat actor from running ransomware. So the threat actor was very much in the network and reportedly has stolen a lot of data, so sensitive data, especially around co-op members. But they didn't actually get to run any encryption, which would have severely affected the business. They managed to pull the plug before that. So that was the best action they could have taken at that point in time. So.
Yeah, so if we had an instant lessons learned, and I know we'll come on to these items, yeah, it's speed of response and decisive action has meant that they are offline for 1 to 2 weeks, but able to get back online. Whereas, you know, we look at other breaches, And you know, we're seeing weeks and weeks to get back to a position where they're trading and operating as they were before. So yeah, I think that's a hugely important point, and one that that we can't miss, or we can't spend a bit of time thinking about. So yeah, to defend against the con, or the that community of cyber criminals and that make up Scattered Spider and others. So I just took a, and I've paraphrased this ever so slightly, but took a little quote from Kevin Beaumont, who's a security researcher. And actually, interestingly, he's a former employee of the co-op. And one of his articles said, if an employ if an internal employee could go rogue and cause significant damage without being prevented or detected, you're in real deep trouble. If an external e-crime or criminal threat actor does the same, which I think is extremely important, because we can break it down into three ways, or at least I can break it down into three ways of thinking about how do we start defending against these attacks. And a large majority, excluding those external controls, but if we think about the internal controls, actually these are exactly the same controls that we need to put in place when we think about an insider threat. Before we come on to that, I just talked about some of the external controls. So, Patrick has talked about the attacks against the help desk impersonation, and things like SIM swapping. But it's important that we make sure that, particularly anything that is external, that we have phish-resistant MFA in place, which definitely means that we shouldn't be doing anything via SMS. So no one-time passwords, because they are very susceptible to SIM swapping that we see far too frequently. In terms of the mitigations for SIM swapping, things like, and Patrick talked about the mobile operators are kind of stepping up their game, but very easily you can put and contact your operator to have a PIN placed on your SIM card. But also, if you want to, examples of where that may have happened, and you might want to raise that to your to security teams, or educate users to raise that to security teams, are things like suddenly your phone stopping working, data stopping working. They can be examples of, actually, do you want my SIM has been subverted? Obviously, strengthening the help desk procedures. And a lot of this really comes down to how do we implement a challenge and response process that we can confirm that people are exactly who we think they are. Information that is not publicly available, things that are very hard for people to guess. So it's not a simple answer. And we say this is it's very easy to sit in a webinar and say, I'm just going to strengthen those help desk controls, put a challenge and response process in place. It is something that is going to be difficult to do, but it's important that that they are things that we start to tackle to make sure they're in place. And then lastly, enhancing that security awareness. I think that's a continuous piece. Deep fakes, I keep mentioning it. I've just done a talk on deep fakes. It's very topical for me. But I think things like that are not fully talked about, even in cybersecurity spheres, but definitely not in the end user space. But making them aware of actually how easy it is, and what we need to look out for when it comes to deep fakes is actually getting harder and harder to be able to do. So let's look at some of those internal controls. So if we think about internal controls, in this middle box, what we're talking about is preventative controls, the ones that can prevent the incident from happening. And one of those, particularly if we look at, the lessons that we can learn from these breaches, which aren't dissimilar to many other breaches, but a lot of it comes down to segregation. On the one hand, the threat actors were able to move laterally. Now, if we're putting network segmentation, and particularly micro segmentation, in place to be able to create those barriers, particularly if we can link that with authentication, then we can restrict, or at least make it extremely difficult, to be able to navigate through the network. We all know that actually, if we're most people will choose the path of least resistance. So the more resistance put in place, actually, we might not be a target that a threat actor really wants to go after. But it's not just the network, it's not just technical. We also need to think about our duties, segregation of duties, to make sure that we are split up so that nobody has far too much access across the business. And also that then bleeds into accounts. So making sure that accounts are very much segregated. So nobody should be using, it almost sounds obvious, but it happens plenty of times. Nobody should be using an admin account. But how much can we then reduce the use of those accounts? And also, domain admins, probably not the right thing for us to have. How can we segment those so that not all of the admin accounts give us complete domain admin across the entire environment? So limiting down to what those are actually used for, specifically to their purpose. And the second point is around privileged account management. We can see in all of these incidents that identities have been targeted. And really, if you look at any attack path, yes, you might start with a standard user account as that first point of compromise. But every single incident is going to have a point of where they are elevating privilege to get privileged accounts. So we need to do everything we can to be able to protect those. Having password vaults, having the continuous changing of passwords, but also the rotation, automatic rotation of passwords. So having a privileged access management plan, it is a lot more important. Or is very important, should I say? But also that needs to apply to how we deal with our third parties. Now, it's only obviously confirmed in here that it's a direct third-party account that's been used, but it's something for us to bear in mind that linked in with that supply chain, how can we ensure that our third parties that we give access to, which more often than not will be a privileged account because we'll have them carrying out some piece of work in our environment, how are we controlling those to ensure that's a single user using that in terms of where they're logging in from, how they're having to request access, and how we're limiting access to what they can to what they can access across the network, and it not be a carte blanche access. And then lastly, which really fits into that insider threat model, and if we're taking these actions, we're killing two birds with one stone here across particularly across these internal ones. We need to start monitoring to look for behavior, and that behavior, we can look at it from a network perspective. So what is normal in the environment? How are we looking for those anomalies, particularly when we're looking at lateral movement across the network? We might have access between these environments, but being able to look at things like peer group analysis and looking at, well, actually that user has never logged into here before, or that machine has never tried to access these services, then we can look at how we can mitigate that and how we can identify it to be able to get in position to identify it. But it's not just network activity, it's definitely user monitoring, user behavior, making sure we're looking from everything from geographically impossible travel, looking at data that is being extracted, and again, as I said previously, looking at the access that they're having and whether that's normal. And then lastly, being able to do central log analysis. So if we look at some of the recommendations for how do we protect the ntds.dip file. Actually, it's very hard to protect. Protection needs to come through that segregation of duties, but also looking at how we can access those. Patrick talked about backups. Quite often, it's not stolen or accessed from the actual domain controller. It's from the backups that aren't protected in the same manner. So we need to think about how we're protecting those. But if we look at the detection side of it, it's being able to monitor things like what's happening in those tier one accounts inside our domain. So domain admin, enterprise admin, looking at changes to those. So I think, particularly when it comes to the response side, we need to make sure we're centrally collecting these logs and analyzing them, as all of the tactics and techniques that are used by groups like Scattered Spider, we can clearly call those all of them out, and they're all evident in process data, network data, login data, system events, registry changes, and we're only going to be able to identify those if we're doing that. The last piece that's probably not on here that ties into all of that is obviously having an EDR solution in place. But I'd be very, very surprised if there's anybody on the call that doesn't already have an EDR solution in place, as we see that's table stakes these days. And then I'll hand over to yourself here, Patrick, for what it's we talked about. How do we look at protecting and preventing it? But actually, it's impossible for us to guarantee the prevention or protection of absolutely everything. So it's definitely a case of when, not if. So let's I'll hand over to yourself to look at what are the things that we should be doing when responding to an incident.
Yeah, thanks, Rich. In terms of runbooks and playbooks, those terms are bandied around a lot, and it can also be goes to call it an incident response process or policy. There's a lot of nomenclature around that, but I think the two key things to have when responding to an incident is it sorry inside that incident response process is an overarching playbook and low-level runbook. So the overarching playbook should be your kind of first port of call. So when you've got a breach, You open this document. You've got it. You should have it printed out as well, just in case, systems get encrypted. But it should be it's an overarching kind of plan. Right, we need this team ready. These are the contacts for that team. Have we got an incident response retainer? Yes, let's bring them in. We're going to do our war room in Slack. We're going to do our war room in Teams or WhatsApp. We're going to inform these senior stakeholders. It should be the kind of high level instructions that should be easy and simple to follow, because at the end of the day, when you're in crisis and your systems are down, you don't want to have to read through an essay of really detailed instructions. So yeah, just absolute get everything ready, call in the troops, and it should have the full all the way process all the way from the beginning to the end. Then you've got your low-level runbook. So this is the second part, and this is where the overarching playbook should then split into these low-level runbooks. So the high-level playbook will give you like high-level instructions, but the low-level runbooks will be things like how to identify the ransomware variant, or how to take a forensic image following correct chain of custody guidelines. How these low-level instructions that there can be no kind of interpretation issues around those instructions. So it's literally, and those instructions should also be tailored to your environment as well. So I've got a screenshot of just like a generic section of one of our runbooks there, which is just on the identification of ransomware, which is obviously an important step if you've seen files being encrypted. And those in your own runbooks, those steps there should be tailored to your environment. So for example, let's say you use I don't know, CrowdStrike or SentinelOne, you should have instructions in there exactly on the exact commands to run or exact steps to follow in, say, SentinelOne to I don't know, pull a file back for analysis or something like that. So it should be the low level stuff, and the runbooks are designed for your IT, basically your first responders, your IT staff that are going to be doing the IT work. Then when responding to an incident, clear leadership is an absolute must. We always recommend in our engagements that you have like an incident manager, so a major incident manager on the customer side and a major incident manager on the incident on the retainer side. But if you don't have a retainer, if it's just one entity, it's just one organization, then just having that major incident manager, that MIM, to basically run the show from a task and a project point of view, but also provide leadership. So big decisions should come from above, obviously, and they need to then filter those decisions down to the staff beneath.
I know that's something that we've seen in incidents where they haven't got the leadership in place, and actually it tends to go hand in hand to where they haven't got a response retainer because they haven't gone through that readiness preparation phase, and impacts the speed of response, the ability to orchestrate, to execute on eradication, containment, disruption, and everything else.
Companies should do regular tabletops and incident simulations. So these are your chance to really get into the weeds of an incident. So whenever I deliver these, I really try and get the customer to think as if they're in an incident. So I'll throw stuff in there. I'll make it quite exciting, but then I'll also make it quite stressful for the full purpose that incidents aren't meant to be fun. Obviously they are for me because I do it as a job, but incidents are meant to be obviously serious, but then you've got to have a clear mind, and you've got to know exactly what to do, and that's where your practice comes in. So that's just like any job, really. Like when you should be firemen, policemen, they all do training, right? Everyone does training, so why shouldn't IT staff do training for the inevitable, which is obviously ransomware or attack like that? Yeah, regular tabletops and incident simulations. Do high level ones for leadership and crisis management, kind of high level stuff, but then also do low level ones as well. So first responder training, that's really important. And then efficient forensics. This is a personal one of mine. It's like an approach that we take here, and that is The machine gun approach in forensics is basically where you typically spread out and you try and run do forensics on as many machines as possible. You utilize the seam. You try and do it all at once, basically. So you try and do the spread effect. Whereas the most efficient way of IR we find is the breadcrumbs approach or the Hansel and Gretel approach, which is to find the initial indicators of compromise, then move back from that. So move follow the breadcrumbs, find out how they got in, what they did, and that means you don't then need to do forensics on 10,000 machines, So it's doable if you've only got 50 or 100 endpoints. It's quick, but when you've got 3,000, 4,000 endpoints, it takes you weeks. So obviously the M&S incident is speculative at this point. M&S are a very big org, but it's possible that to begin with, anyway, before they brought in an external forensics provider, it's possible that they were kind of they didn't know what to target because the breach was so vast, this breach was so big, they didn't know where to target first. And then finally, clear external comms. So we're talking here about PR. So PR, you've got to obviously make sure that you're not giving away too much, but then at the same time, you've got to give the public a certain amount of information, especially if you are especially if you're a publicly traded company.
Yeah, and I think just got we'll probably sort of wrap up there and move on to the Q&A because we've got a lot of questions in and very little time to answer them. But just the last piece on that, I think it's a trio between incident response, legal for that crisis management and advice from that perspective, and then comms from a PR perspective to get that right. So it's probably worth looking at each of those angles to be able to respond very well and efficiently and effectively to an incident. So I think that wraps up the presentation. We'll jump straight into the Q&A. As I say, we've only got 6 minutes or probably five and a half at this stage to cover off some of those questions. But I will say that we're probably not going to cover them all off in that time, but we will follow up and respond to each one of these. I'm going to start with my new favorite question that came in from an anonymous attendee, and I can probably figure out why, because the question is, will this seminar be available to download so I can share with the overpaid uneducated? I don't know who's asked that, but the answer is yes, it will be available, particularly for rewatch and on demand, and we'll be sharing the artifacts as well. So we've answered that one. So we'll just move on to another question. I think there's a question about what do we do to ensure that our mobile provider prevents SIM swapping. We've kind of covered that one, so I think we'll tick that one off as well very quickly. Can I ask if you know what privileges the targeted M&S account had, standard user or admin? I don't. The answer is we don't know that, and unless we do, Patrick, and I wasn't aware.
No.
We can speculate that if we look at the attack chain, we look at what has happened in previous attacks. The target isn't generally going to be an admin account initially. Generally, because they're much harder to, better protected, much harder to infiltrate, and potentially, more closely monitored, particularly from an external perspective. More than likely, it would have been a standard user account, and then the job is to, evade detection from EDR platforms once they've got access to a system, and then be in a position to elevate credentials to then be able to move laterally across the environment to then act on their objectives, which is most likely would have happened at this point. So we'll tick that one off. The next one I'll throw it your way, Patrick, is how can we, or I suppose it's what can we do, sorry, I'll have to read, to protect our ESXi servers from being compromised?
Yeah, we get sorry, I'm not on mute, am I? No. So we get asked this one quite a lot because it comes up in incidents because the ESXi the or the hypervisor it doesn't have to be ESXi, it could be the Windows equivalent or it could be Oracle as well. So for the actual ESXi itself, which is the hypervisor, it holds all the hosts, all the virtual machines. That's the ultimate goal of the threat actor to get onto, because like I said earlier, if they can encrypt the hosts, they can encrypt them from the hypervisor level and not the underlying operating systems, then they're quit in basically. So to protect against that, there's a few things we recommend. So the most important one being MFA. So you can get MFA for you can install it, so with a hardware token. So you need a hardware token to log in to the back end. So we're talking shell access to the ESXi. I'm not talking front end access here through vSphere, through the GUI. I'm talking back end access, because back end access is how the attackers get on there, and they run the ransomware, because essentially it's just a scriptable environment. It's just a bash environment, in Linux. So MFA with hard token is one of them. Another one is don't use domain credentials. So don't allow pass through from LDAP. Do local instead, local credentials, and keep the credentials off site. So don't have them in a, obviously it goes without saying, don't put them in a password safe. Don't put them in a text a text file. We've seen it before. But yeah, just really protect those creds like they are your crown jewels. And then finally, is backups. So just make sure you do full backups, but then they're off-site as well of the ESXi environment. Because what we think might have happened in the MNS case is that the threat actors got in, they got to the ESXis, and then they actually compromised maybe three months worth of backups or more, which means that if you've got no backups going back 3 or 4 months, and you've got to recreate all that data. No employees are going to get paid. I know that the employees have to get paid their recent pay package. They're not actually up to date pay. So they just had to guess their pay basically, which suggests that they didn't have backups of their like all their payment information. So yeah, backups up to date. Backups held from far, far back, but it's held off site. So.
Okay, so I mean, we've got 1 minute left. So I'm just gonna. There's one question about can we get the slides? Yes, of course. The last question came from. I'm just gonna, because it's a tricky one. Put you on the spot, Patrick, or maybe myself. Came from Steve Molinex, and it's. We have no direct network-to-network connections with customers, but we do have multiple APIs. Can APIs be hijacked? Thoughts there, Patrick? I've got my thoughts. You've got about 30 seconds.
Yes, they can. API key leak. So because effectively an API secret is sort of like a password, you need that to be able to authenticate to get the data. So if that gets stolen, then yeah, they can steal the data there.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, if you've compromised the end machine that you're making API calls to, or the reverse, then obviously you can. Obviously, every environment is very different, an application very different. But we've seen it in ones that we've assessed from a penetration testing point of view, where it is possible to feed information in via the API that the system is then using, and effectively creating a pseudo remote code execution capability. So that is very potential, the potential there. So we are on the hour, and we generally trying to keep these to 45 to 60 minutes in total. So we are going to close. I think just the last things, we've got some other upcoming webinars that please sign up to for some more insights. We have about probably 8 questions that we haven't managed to answer live, and we will answer those, and that will be sent through as part of the follow-up with a link for the on-demand viewing alongside the slides. So the last thing is just for me to thank Patrick for joining me today to talk through this, but then importantly to thank everybody else for joining today and spending an hour with us to talk about what I think is a really important subject and some great learnings that we can take away from it. Thank you very
Cheers
much.
all. Thanks all.